From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Baseball is not life itself, although the resemblance keeps coming up. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the man who made that observation, Roger Angel. He writes about the national pastime for The New Yorker magazine. Also today, I speak with novelist Alice Adams. One of the characters in her new novel makes this observation, that in her 60s, she's become as prudish about disease as she once was about sex. Lord Schwartz reviews a new reissue that demonstrates why he thinks Joseph Sigeti was the greatest violinist of the century. And our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, says you have to speak English if you want to sing the blues. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Roger Angel says that he's usually described as a baseball essayist, a baseball historian, or a baseball poet, but he declines the honors. He thinks of himself as writing autobiography, the story of himself as a fan. He's written that continuing story since 1962, describing the baseball games and players and seasons he's watched, always trying to get at why it fascinates him. Angel's baseball essays are published in the New Yorker magazine, where he also works as the senior fiction editor. Every few years, Angel's baseball articles are collected in book form. His new book is titled Season Ticket. This week's edition of The New Yorker features Angel's annual piece on spring training. He once wrote that springtime is almost his favorite part of the baseball year. I asked him why.
The whole game is a little more accessible. Baseball is so difficult, really, for fans. The season itself has a lot of tension to it, and the players are harder to talk to because they're caught up in competition. And in spring training, particularly in Arizona, for some reason, the players seem a lot closer. The fact that the games don't count relieves us from the burden of importance that real fans put on every game. It's informal. It's the official end of winter. Baseball is, you know, is one of the greatest. Spring training is one of the greatest public relations devices that anybody ever thought up. It's wonderful, and you watch a little baseball, you watch some fly balls, and you think of your friends back home in the slush and the snow, and you feel superior.
Now, you've also written that your secret fear is that you'll find nothing fresh at spring training to write about, but that baseball always saves you. Well, what saved you from that this year?
Well, I talked to a lot of. I had no particular theme this year. I talked to some players that I wanted to talk to for various reasons. I talked to Bob Boone because he's now played more games at catcher than the hardest position of all than anybody in baseball history. I talked to Tony Gwynn, a wonderful young hitter. I talked to Dewey Evans because at the age of 36 of the Red Sox, he had the best season ever. And in the end, it sort of did come together as a theme because these men are super professionals. And once again, I realized how much more competitive, how much stronger their wills are than the rest of us who weren't tested every day the way professional athletes are, and particularly the way baseball players are.
Pete, do you still wake up worrying, will there be anything new and exciting that I really want to write about this year?
Well, I don't anymore, Terry, because my cure for this, somewhere in my book, I've written that expertise is the cure for partisanship. I'm still trying to learn baseball. I've been writing about it for 25 years, and there's a lot I don't know. There's a lot I pick up almost every time I go to a game.
Well, one of the things you really love to do is to get pitchers to demonstrate pitches to you, and catchers to show you how they stand, and you know, infielders to show you how they catch and throw.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this book. I've sort of gone around from position to position and tried to learn how this game is really played. There's a whole, I think, a fascinating chapter on catching because. Of all the skills, catching is the one that's most overlooked, perhaps because the catchers face away from us or something, or perhaps because we sort of always patronize them a little bit, because when we were kids, they were the fat kids who, when we played ball, they were the fat kids who couldn't do anything else. But there's a lot to catching, an enormous amount if you think about it. The catcher is usually the smartest guy on the team, and he runs the game, and particularly he runs the pitchers, and he has to get top performance out of a group of different pitchers day after day, many of whom are not pitching at their best. It's a fascinating job. And, of course, he has to deal with umpires. And the relationship between catchers and umpires is extremely subtle. And there's a lot going on back there. And there are exchanges and conversations you don't see because the catcher can't turn around and talk to the umpire. But I learned a lot.
There's a slightly revised strike zone this year and a new balk rule. Are you a traditionalist, or do you like to see things change like that?
Well, the balk rule, to try to deal with that first, this has nothing to do with tradition. The umpires over the years, for just as a fad, I think, had, for some reason, had more and more given up the top levels of the strike zone. They just weren't calling anything above the waist, although it officially went up as high as the armpits. And they were calling lower and lower strikes. I'm talking about the strike zone, actually, not the balk rule. And I think that the leagues decided to, it's strange enough, they have slightly narrowed the strike zone. They brought the top level of it down and then instructed the umpires to call that. So they're going to be calling more higher strikes. And we'll see what happens. I think that it's probably, and I think there'll be fewer home runs because the pitchers have a slightly larger strike zone to work to. The balk rule, they're trying to, the leagues decided to try to stop a form of bending of the rules, if not cheating, where the pitchers would not come to a complete halt with a base runner on first. And there's been a lot of complaining because the pitchers have to give up their traditional motion, whatever it is that they've learned to do, and come to a full stop with both feet on the ground. There's been a terrific fuss about this, but I think it's a spring fuss, and I think it'll die down in another month or so, and the umpires will give a little bit, and then we'll go on to the next thing in the season.
You've been writing about baseball since 1962. Are there any really major ways that you think you've seen the sport change?
I think the biggest change has been the increase in AstroTurf, the artificial turf, which really has changed the game. You have to have much faster infielders, quicker, better athletes out there because the ball flies by you so fast. And we've lost a few kinds of infield plays as a result, which is too bad. And You see, there are still some those AstroTurf bounced hits. The ball is chopped on the ground and bounces over the infielder's head, which is sort of a perversion of the game. And the other complaint about, I guess the main complaint about, or to me the two main complaints are that it's very hard on the athlete's legs. There's a lot of wear and tear on AstroTurf. It's really like running on cement, slightly cushioned cement. And You've lost natural grass, which to me is one of the pleasures of baseball. You go and there should be a beautiful lawn out there, and the feeling that you're in the country, even if you're not, you know, it's a special part of the game.
You know, in 1982, you wrote that Big League Baseball is long past its innocent youth and well into what appears to be a disordered and self-destructive sort of middle age. Do you think that's still true?
I think things are somewhat better ordered than they were. I wrote that during the time of expansion, I think, and the beginning of the great labor troubles that went on for so long. But a lot of issues have been put aside by the Players Association and the owners, and the basic agreement comes up for renegotiation. The new contract has to be drawn a year from this coming winter, and there are a lot of issues that may cause immense difficulties, and I just hope it's not going to come to another strike. I hope the owners have learned that the players are grown-ups and that if they feel they need to strike, they will do so. Before the great strike in 81, I kept hearing the owners saying, these kids, they'll never go out on strike. They won't go out on strike. I know them, and of course they did go out on strike. So I'm troubled about what's going to happen, and there's some major issues that have to be resolved about expansion and so forth, but I think the game is in better condition than it was a few years ago.
You know, that quote that I just read was also quoted in a newspaper editorial earlier this month. And the subject of the editorial was in part the way that the stadiums have degraded and the way that fans' behavior in the stadiums has degraded. And in the editorial, the writers wrote that they suggested that the parks are often dirty, the fans are rude and are sometimes dangerous, and that alcohol is usually the culprit. And the editorial calls for, you know, trying to cut down on the amount of alcohol and commends stadiums that have cut back on alcohol sales, that have limited alcohol sales. What do you think of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely agree. I think that it's not a great sacrifice to cut down on beer sales. I think if the more this goes on, the more we'll find families staying at home, families with young children. It's a real threat to the game because if you're going to get audiences that are violent, it's inappropriate to baseball in the first place. A lot of this comes out of the enormous expectations, the enormous emphasis on winning that is imposed by a lot of owners, a number of owners, people like George Steinbrenner, and by the television networks too. Winning seems to be everything, and winning is is, although everyone wants to win and every team wants to win, every player wants to win, strangely enough, it can't be at the top of the list in baseball because it's such an unforgiving game, such a difficult game. You can't dominate it. George Steinbrenner keeps trying to muscle his way to victory and to chastise his troops to go on winning. And it doesn't work that way. I mean, after all, the most successful ball players are only successful about a third of the time. You strike out or pop up or whatever. Two-thirds of the time, if you get a base hit, one-third of the time, you're a hero. It doesn't work that way. And people become impatient, I think, in big crowded stadiums if this is the message they're getting from the owners. There are teams and owners around who have gone the other way, who have saying go to the game. The pleasure of being at the park is the number one thing. Bill Veeck always said that baseball is meant to be savored, and he had a deep understanding of that. There are some fans who were, you know, as intense as any, and sometimes very loud and vehement, the Cubs fans I'm thinking of, who seem to understand this and take the game with a little more patience.
Roger Angel is my guest. He writes about baseball for the New Yorker magazine, and a new collection of his pieces has just been published. It's titled Season Ticket. When you go see a game, are you usually in the press box, or are you mingling with the fans?
Well, I do both. I go in the press box because it's comfortable and I get a good seat. But I try as often as possible to go with a friend or with my family and sit in the stands too, because the presence of fans is a crucial part of this. And I am a fan. I'm allowed to write as a fan. I write for the New Yorker and in these pieces that make books now. This new book, Season Ticket. There's a lot of references to we, meaning we fans. And I can talk about myself as a fan, and readers of mine know which teams I care most about.
So what's the difference between writing as a fan and writing as a sports writer for a newspaper?
Well, I think objectivity is fine. I guess you have to have it if you're a newspaper writer, but I think that the beat men, the people who cover all the teams, are fans. All the ones I know are fans, although they try to keep it quiet. But if in an important game late in the year, you'll see them, their eyes lighting up, and they will exclaim with happily if something good happens out there. Although they try to hide it, they try to be tougher than that. But this is an involving game. So being a fan is a great pleasure. It's a great privilege to be a fan. And since I can write in this personal fashion, I think sometimes I'm trying to speak for the fans. Well, I can't speak for all the fans, but they're the unheard and very important voice in this whole complex business.
You know, another difference between your writing and the writing of sports writers who work for a sports magazine or for a newspaper is that they have to, after the game most of the time, just go back and bang out an article, whereas you have weeks, if not months, to mull over what you've been observing.
Well, I'm not sure it's an advantage. There are times when a few weeks have gone by and I've got several notebooks full of notes and I wish my pieces were over. But, I think that my pieces show a different pace, a different sense of the game. Strangely enough, I often can go back and go into detail about what happened in an important game. A lot of that is being left out of daily writing now because of television. People, the feeling is that
everybody's seen it.
Yeah, they've seen it. They know about how the runs were scored. And I can go back and show how the runs were scored. And that's one of the great things about baseball. It is linear. One thing happens, then another thing happens. And you can keep score. You can take notes. You can think about what happened. And you can recreate it. You can recreate it on paper. Or if you're a fan, you can recreate it in your mind. It's wonderful. Games stay with you for years. You can lie in bed and replay a couple of innings of a game that you saw last year. And you can't do that with other sports.
You know, another special thing about your writing is the way you pull back from the individual game and you muse about the season and about the sport and about the people who play it. And I think this is a good time to ask you to read something from your new book. We have a section that we've already chosen. Can you read a passage for us?
Sure, Sherry.
And this is from Roger Angel's new collection of articles titled Season Ticket.
Baseball is not life itself, although the resemblance keeps coming up. It's probably a good idea to keep the two sorted out, but old fans, if they're anything like me, can't help noticing how cunningly our game replicates the larger schedule, with its beguiling April optimism, the cheerful roughhouse of June, the grinding, serious, unending, surely unending business of midsummer, the September settling of accounts when hopes must be traded in for philosophies or brave smiles, and then the abrupt running down of autumn, when we wish for, almost demand, a prolonged and glittering final adventure just before the curtain. But nowhere is this metaphor more insistent than in baseball's sense of slippage. our rueful, fleeting awareness that we tend to pay attention to the wrong things, to last night's rally or tomorrow's pitching matchup, while lesser and sweeter moments slide by unperceived. Players notice this too. Bob Gibson, the most competitive man I've ever seen in the ball field, once told me that what he missed most after he had retired wasn't the competition at all. I don't miss the pitching, but I can't say I don't miss the game, the Cardinal Hall of Famer said. I miss it a little. There's a lot I don't want to get back to. I think it's the life I miss, all the activity that's around baseball. I don't miss playing baseball, but I miss baseball. Baseball. Does that sound like a crazy man?
I like that, and I think you probably really related to that quote about missing the life, not so much the playing of the game, but the life. And I bet you have a life like that as a sports writer, that you have a baseball life during the season.
Yeah, a lot happens, and I have a lot of baseball friends, and I've reached the age now where things come up that suddenly thrill me. I was in spring training this year, and in Port St. Lucie, the new Mets the training center, and I suddenly noticed the Dodgers were there, and I suddenly noticed that the man pitching batting practice was Sandy Koufax, and who retired in the 60s, still maybe the best pitcher, certainly the best left-hander I ever saw. And I couldn't get over it. My scalp prickled, and I looked around, and there were a few other people, slightly older baseball people. Bart Giamatti, the president of the National League, was there, and Tim McCarver, who is now Mets broadcaster, Joe Durso of the Times, and we looked at each other and we all felt the same thing. That's Sandy Koufax out there, and the same motion, seeing that the way he bows his back, and then that over the top delivery was terrifically exciting. Ed Vargo, who was the chief of umpires for the National League, was there, and his eyes lit up, and he told us that he had, as it happened, had been behind the plate for two of Koufax's no-hit games, including the perfect game he once threw. And he described the last batter of that perfect game coming up, who was Harvey Keene. And that's Harvey Keene, who recently died, is a batter I can still see in my mind's eye. I see how the way he ran down to first with his helmet bobbing because he ran so hard. That Harvey Keene came up with two out of the ninth. Nobody had been on first base. And he turned to Vargo, and he's the umpire, and he said, "Ed, anything close, call it right away. Get me out of here. Don't embarrass me."
We're going to take
and
a little.
He struck out.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break here before we talk some more. My guest is Roger Angel, who writes about baseball for the New Yorker magazine. He's also the fiction editor there. His new collection of baseball pieces is called Season Ticket. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Roger Angel is my guest, who writes about baseball for the New Yorker magazine and is the author of the new anthology, Season Ticket. Well, you just read us that really nice passage a couple of minutes ago. And, I mean, your baseball writing is really pretty different from the daily baseball journalism, much more elegiac in a way? Is that
well,
the right word?
I think it's sometimes elegiac. I hope it isn't always elegiac. Sometimes called an essayist of baseball, but I think of these pieces as reporting, basically.
Yeah.
And the main difference may be that I'm reporting a little bit later, so there isn't quite as much urgency to and the sort of artificial excitement that is pumped in unconsciously by everybody who's doing baseball or doing sports on the moment. But I think that since this is about me, it is probably more personal as well as about me as a fan.
Uh-huh.
And one of the great rewards of my work is that I hear from other fans around the country, and they write me about their experiences. And some of them have become almost stringers of mine. People write me and said, "What you don't know, you don't know what's
right.
happening out here with the Padres because you're too far away, or this great thing happened yesterday." So I'm kept up to date in a very personal way. Belonging to baseball is the way I think of it, is what fans do. And it's very much like a family. There's a family feeling with all these old ancestors and heroes that we all share.
You know, you keep talking about writing about baseball from a fan's perspective, and I'm reminded of a book that Christopher Lehmann-Haupt, who's the book critic for the New York Times, he spent a season, I think, acting, traveling around, following baseball and writing about it for a book. And he as I recall from the book, felt really kind of in awe of actually meeting all these fans, all these players he had admired for so long. And he was initially very self-conscious about asking them questions, and was especially self-conscious when he was in the locker room with them. And here were his heroes, you know, half clothed, and he was asking them questions. Did you go through something like that when you started writing?
Sure. When I started, Jerry, I certainly felt that way, and I basically sat in the stands for 2 or 3 years.
Before you got up the courage?
Well, I just felt I didn't know as much as the other writers. I didn't want to take up the player's time with dumb questions. I've learned a little bit more now, and the players, they don't care who asks them a question. They barely notice in many cases. But I think at times I've learned to ask the right question, and I think that these players are really dying to talk about the game, particularly if you can get close enough to what they're thinking about it, how difficult it is, the enormous demands of batting. I mean, I there's a chapter in here that starts off with a description of Carl Yastrzemski's last day, basically his last couple of days in the major leagues. He played more games than anybody in the American League history. And someone near the end, the game was always very difficult for Yastrzemski. He demanded so much of himself, more than other people almost. And someone that last week found a little note that he taped up inside his locker, which said, all weight on back foot, head forward, whatever. He was describing to himself the proper batting stance right to the end. He was trying to learn this game, which just stuns me. It's amazing. And that for players like that, it isn't always much fun. I always felt that for Yaz, he had a sort of a funereal look because the game had taken so much out of him. And just near the end, the last week or so, he began to brighten up because he knew that this pressure he'd put on himself for 20-odd years in the major leagues was about to be relieved.
You know, I have to ask you a couple of things about working at the New Yorker magazine. I recently read here at the New Yorker Brendan Gill's book about life at the New Yorker. And Gill described you as having an athletic prowess that distinguished you from your colleagues and said that you kept them in awe with your ability to jump onto a tabletop from a standing position. And I was wondering...
I haven't tried it in about 10 years. I'm not sure I could still do it.
I was wondering how you mastered that in the first place. It's not something many of us
I think
know
I
to
was
do.
Trying to fill an empty afternoon or something. or I'm tired of rejecting or whatever I was doing. But
do you think of yourself as athletic?
No, I mean, I'm fairly trim, but I'm 67 years old, and I'm not about to go out and play 5 sets of singles, but I'm okay.
I guess the other thing I wanted to know is that I know your mother was Catherine White, who was an editor at The New Yorker, and your stepfather was E.B. White, who wrote for The New Yorker. And I wonder if you were intimidated when you started working there because people who were connected to you in a family way had been so important to the magazine.
Well, I wasn't, because I didn't actually go to work as an editor of The New Yorker until I was in my 40s. I'd been working for 15 years on other magazines, and I'd been a contributor for years. I'd written a lot of fiction and humor and different things, so I felt that I had earned my license there. I didn't have to, there was no fear. Nobody felt that I was coming there under false pretenses. And by the time I arrived at the office, my mother had retired, and they were living in Maine. My stepfather was certainly an influence on my writing. I hope.
How so?
Well, I could see watching him, and I could remember him. He used to write notes and comment every week, and I can remember him working from Maine and working all day and half the next day with the door closed and coming out at lunchtime and shaking his head miserably and saying it isn't going well and he'll never get this done, and then putting it in the mail and sometimes trying to get the mail back because it wasn't any good. But what came out, of course, was so effortless and light and beautifully, such a simple and direct and that wonderful glass-like clarity of his writing. And in a way, I think that's a model for all writers. You want to be clear. You want to make it seem effortless. And, of course, it never is effortless. Writing is very difficult. It's difficult for me, and it's difficult for everybody, I think.
So that experience taught you not to be scared at how difficult writing is.
Or
and
it
not
helped.
To think that it could.
It helped a little.
right. Yeah. I guess you never really get over that that fear. Well, that reminds me, the opening quote in your book is a quote from Ted Williams, and the quote is, "Don't you know how hard this all is?" And the quote refers to batting in particular and baseball in general. But I figured that quote had resonance to you, maybe even about writing.
Well, but it does. But I hope the difficulty of writing doesn't show in the writing. But I don't think it does. But the great thing about baseball is that it really is hard. These people, I mean, I'm in awe of people who sustain a long career in baseball because it is grindingly difficult. And, of course, those stats are kept in the slightest letdown, and everybody in the world knows it. You just can't dominate the game. At this moment, the Baltimore Orioles have lost 19 games in a row. All those men are professionals. They are deeply embarrassed. Pride is what motivates professional athletes. And you would think, I think fans tend to think, well, if they only try harder, if only this, if only that. But it doesn't work that way, particularly in baseball. You can't turn it the way you want it to, which is it's hard to be a fan when your team starts to lose. It's hard to be a player every day, and sometimes you just have to wait until the end of the string runs out, and somehow you win a game. You end a streak. Things get better.
Why is baseball always considered the writer's sport? I mean, you're a good person to ask this since you've written about it so well for so long.
Well, I think it's the manner we touched on earlier, Sherry. It's linear. Baseball is a lot of ways it's not like other sports. There's no clock. The ball is not involved in the scoring. It moves at a different pace. One thing happens, then another thing happens, and then something else happens after that. And you can think about it, and you can go back and look at your scorecard, or you can look at what's happening to the pitcher out there, or how the batters are trying to attack the pitcher, and you can see things beginning to happen. This is very much like writing a book or like reading a book. It's even occurred to me that baseball and reading are not dissimilar, because both occupations are for people who aren't afraid of being bored. Sometimes baseball is boring. It's part of its pleasure almost that you're there, nothing much is happening, and you can think about other things. But you need those early chapters, those early innings, if you're going to have a riveting conclusion at the end. If something very complicated and releasing and exciting is going to happen in the latter chapters.
No, it's interesting that you've written some fiction. You're a fiction editor at The New Yorker, but it's really the baseball writing that you've become best known for.
Well, I sure didn't plan it that way. I mean, I didn't have any particular... I certainly never planned to be writing about this for 25 years, but... I feel very fortunate. I mean, it's given me a whole different life. I have an office life, an editor's life, and a writer's life. It has given me a whole group of friends and associations. It's given me a little attention, whatever. And it's allowed me to write about myself, which is what all writers want to do deep down. It's been very lucky, and I hope it goes on. I plan to keep on with this as long as I can.
Gene, it gets you out of the office and into the sun while you're still writing.
Yeah, that's right.
not a bad thing. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing and about baseball. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Roger Angel, and he writes about baseball for The New Yorker magazine. This week his annual spring training piece is in. A collection of his pieces has just been published. It's titled Season Ticket, A Baseball Companion, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor John Lithgow. He starred as a transsexual in The World According to Garp and as a fundamentalist minister in Footloose. He's currently starring in the Broadway show M. Butterfly. I hope you can join us.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack.
I don't care if I never get back. Oh, we'll root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Mr. Kelly loves baseball games.
Why, I know all the players. I know all the names. I was raised with a baseball bat.
Well, fancy that. Fancy that. You know a man named DiMaggio?
Well, I know him so well that I call him Joe.
Oh, this is really great.
Uh-huh.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. You see things differently as you get older. Coming up, we find out how novelist Alice Adams sees things these days. At the age of 62, she's written a novel that she sees as kind of a rehearsal for old age. Nearly 50 years after the late Joseph Sigodi recorded Bloch's Violin Concerto, it's been reissued on compact disc. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the recording's a great way to get introduced to the artist he calls the greatest violinist of the century. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explains how a trip to Rome led him to think about American blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The omnibus trade bill passed the Senate this afternoon. The vote was 63-36. President Reagan has promised to veto the bill, and the vote in the Senate today would not be sufficient for an override. The House passed the bill last week. President Reagan's main objection to the bill is a provision that would require employers to give their workers notice before they shut down plants. The Reagan administration has notified Congress it plans to sell an arms package worth $825 million to the Saudis, despite congressional opposition following the Saudi purchase of Chinese missiles. Details from NPR's Ann Garrels.
When the Saudis secretly purchased Chinese missiles capable of hitting Israel, many in Congress demanded the proposed sale be delayed. But after recent Saudi moves, administration officials decided they had a good case to push forward. Yesterday, the Saudis signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, showing they have no intention of arming their new Chinese missiles with nuclear warheads. The Saudis also broke relations with Iran. U.S. officials will highlight these actions and argue the arms package under consideration is as good for the U.S. as it is for the Saudis. The package includes maintenance equipment for the Saudi AWACS. Information collected by these surveillance planes is shared with U.S. warships operating in the Persian Gulf. Officials say without the new equipment, the Saudi AWACS will not function. Bradley fighting vehicles make up the remainder of the arms package, about $500 million. U.S. officials will argue these do not threaten Israel. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney met with President Reagan today, but he made no progress in getting the president to join Canada in making reductions in the toxic emissions that cause acid rain. After failing at the White House, Mulroney took his case to Congress. NPR's Jim Engel reports.
The Reagan administration has reduced somewhat the U.S. output of toxic emissions, but in international negotiations, it is now pressing for the right to increase some of those emissions, and the administration has resisted Canadian calls for specific targets and timetables for further reductions. In his speech to the joint session of Congress today, Mulroney said Canada is now reducing its own emissions by half and isn't asking the U.S. to do any more. And he directly challenged the assertion of the Reagan administration that scientific research has not yet established the damage from toxic emissions.
It is despoiling your environment as inexorably as it is ours. It is damaging your environment from Michigan to Maine and threatens marine life on the eastern seaboard. It's a rapidly escalating ecological tragedy in this country as well as ours.
Mulroney asked Congress and the administration to agree to specific targets for reductions, but a senior administration official said this week such an agreement is not likely before Ronald Reagan leaves office. I'm Jim Engel in Washington.
Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca said today that the number three automaker will delay closing its Kenosha, Wisconsin plant until the end of the year. Iacocca also said Chrysler will not move production of its K car to Mexico, as it had announced last week. The decision to keep making subcompact and large luxury cars in Kenosha is the result of stronger than expected sales. At a news conference, Iacocca said Chrysler discussed the decision with Wisconsin officials.
They felt that if we could in some way extend production, they've been really prodding us on this issue, and I said we'd take a good close look at it, and we think we can do this. We don't have all the orders in hand, but we think it's a good business risk.
Chrysler's first quarter profits fell almost 32% from a year ago. Iacocca announced today first quarter profits of more than $183 million. The loss was due largely to a one-time charge to cover the costs of previously announced plant closings in Chrysler's Acustar parts subsidiary. The charge resulted in a $93 million reduction in net earnings. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The recording you're about to hear features the musician classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz describes as the greatest violinist he's ever heard, the Hungarian Joseph Szigeti. Szigeti died in 1973 at the age of 80. This new compact disc includes Szigeti's 1939 live performance of the Bach Violin Concerto with the controversial conductor Willem Mengelberg and the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam.
I couldn't believe the good news that there was finally a Joseph Szigeti performance on CD, miraculously preserved from a live concert 49 years ago. There's no question in my mind that Szigeti is the greatest violinist of this century, certainly the greatest violinist who ever recorded. When he's playing beautifully, it's the most thrilling violin tone ever created, deep and vibrant and luscious. His performances not only sing, but speak. His phrasing astounds you with its variety of vocal color and inflection, and always just below even the most beautiful surface is the intuition of tragedy. Szigeti, like Maria Callas, believed that music shouldn't be merely beautiful. It must express something, and not everything it expresses is pretty. There are rough spots, passages of strain and striving. To smooth them out, to make them sound effortless, would be to lose the musical point. Ernest Bloch's Violin Concerto isn't the greatest piece of music Szigeti played. In fact, he's much better known for more classical pieces, the Bach solo partitas and sonatas, Mozart and Beethoven sonatas, the violin concertos of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Brahms. But Szigeti championed 20th century music, unlike some of our contemporary superstars. He played Debussy, Ives, Prokofiev, Henry Cowell, and of course his own countryman and friend, Béla Bartók. Bloch completed his violin concerto in 1938 after 8 years of work and dedicated it to Szigeti. Szigeti recorded it commercially shortly after its world premiere and played it frequently. The performance heard on this new disc came less than a year later. Bloch is probably still best remembered for his compositions on Jewish themes, pieces like Shlomo and Baal Shem. You can hear these themes in the violin concerto.
Thank you.
But Bloch said he based this piece on American Indian themes, and you can hear those too, especially in Sigeti's buoyant rhythms. Both ethnic backgrounds have a deep melancholy spirit. And finally, it is that rich melancholy rather than any ethnic origin that really characterizes this concerto. The conductor here is Willem Mengelberg, one of the most imaginative and idiosyncratic conductors of the century, another tireless champion of contemporary music, especially the music of Mahler. He directed the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam for over 50 years, beginning in 1895. As far as I know, this is his only recorded collaboration with Sigeti, another reason to cherish it. The disc also includes Mengelberg conducting pianist Walter Gieseking in a rippling live performance of Debussy's early and showy Fantasy for Piano and Orchestra, recorded in 1938.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new music and arts compact disc with soloists Joseph Sigeti and Walter Gieseking. This is Fresh Air. Alice Adams has written about friendship, love, and marriage in her novels such as Listening to Billy, Rich Rewards, and the bestseller Superior Women. In her new novel, Second Chances, she continues those themes, but from the perspective of men and women in their 60s and 70s. Adams just entered her 60s. I asked her if by writing this book she was preparing herself for getting older.
You know, let's face it, 60 is not middle-aged. I do not know a lot of people who are 120. So I began to think, you know, what will over 60 be like? And I began to think about that, and at the same time, in a rather conscious way, to watch people I knew who were in that age group called OLD.
Well, is OLD something that scares you, or is it something that you want to make sure you can make as interesting as being younger has been?
I would sure like it to be a lot less strenuous than being younger has been. No, it doesn't scare me. At this point, it really doesn't. I'm interested in it.
Did you have to reach a certain age before you felt that you could really write with authority and convincingly about older people?
Well, of course I did, but really, perhaps more important, I wasn't even remotely interested in older people when I was 20, 30, even 40. I was so desperately concerned with myself and my own age and my contemporaries.
At this point, I think I'd like for you to read an excerpt from your new novel. And we've already picked out the excerpt, but I'm going to ask you to just set it up a little bit. And this is an excerpt from Alice Adams' new novel, Second Chances.
Okay, the novel begins with two very old friends. They've been friends all their lives, a woman named Dudley and a man named Edward. And it's New Year's Day, 1985, and they're taking a walk in the hills south of San Francisco. And it's pretty cold, and they're a little breathless. But they're big talkers. They always have been. At that moment, Dudley is struck by a new thought that she is unable not to communicate to Edward. "Have you noticed how prudish we are about diseases, all of us?" she asks him. "Especially cancer. It's sort of the way we were about sex a long time ago. Something not quite to be mentioned. Something very much involving our bodies, causing a lot of secret speculation." By way of response, Edward frowns, so that Dudley worries again about his cough. Could she possibly have said precisely the wrong thing? Can Edward have? Almost instantly, though, he reassures her. Well, if you feel the same positive terror that I do every time I go in for an examination, I don't mind telling you. Well, really, it's no wonder that we're prudish. I can't tell you the relief just last week. But he looks very glum, and Dudley decides that she has indeed said a wrong thing. Besides, she and Edward have never in their 50-odd years of friendship had a talk about sex. How could they? No more than they could discuss cancer.
It's such an interesting realization that people are becoming, at that age, as prudish in talking about diseases, or especially cancer, as they once were in discussing sex. And I'd love to hear, what made you think about that comparison?
I have no idea. It's one of those things that plunked itself into my alleged mind. But it seemed, you know, it's one of those thoughts that come and you think, ah, that's right.
You know, one thing I find very moving about this book is that as these characters are getting older and facing their own mortality, younger people they know are dying of AIDS, of accidental death.
Yes.
And,
well,
yeah.
I'm afraid that's my perception of how things are.
It's very upsetting.
Deeply, extremely. I had a very moving conversation the other day with a friend whose son had died of AIDS, and one of the things that he said was that the wrongness of it. He said, you know, I was supposed, you know, he was supposed to outlive me.
Well, it's become so frightening seeing so many people dying of AIDS. You start to...
It's hard. Yeah.
And it puts age and dying of age into a totally different perspective, too.
Does, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, I would think that I hope that these survivors at the end of this particular book have a certain sense of their luck, simply in that there they are together and they're for the most part okay.
In a way, I think it kind of gives them courage to change, and to not see themselves as having to remain exactly the same just because they're old.
Well, I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but I hope that's true. Yeah.
What kinds of women interest you? As characters in fiction, in your fiction?
Well, it depends. That's awfully hard to say in a general way. It entirely depends what I'm writing. While I was writing Second Chances, older women interested me. At the moment, the novel that I'm now writing concerns mainly a woman who has five daughters, so I'm interested in that as a phenomenon. I read once an interview with Muriel Spark in which she said that in the curious way that life has of imitating one's art, whenever she was writing a book, somehow the life that she needed floated towards her, and I've rather found that. She said, for instance, and this was striking, that when she was writing a book called The Bachelors, everyone she met turned out to be a bachelor. I can think of a lot of people who would envy that.
So when you were writing your new book, you met a lot of older women?
That's right. That's exactly, yes.
Was this just serendipity?
Absolutely. Yes, that's the whole point.
I don't know. You think maybe you leave yourself open more to that kind of experience when you're writing?
I think it's a rather strange and mysterious thing. I mean, there's a quality of prescience, I think, about writing fiction.
You wrote your first book in 1966, at least it was published in 1966. Then your next book is published in 1974. What happened in between, in those intervening years? What happened with your writing?
I was writing short stories. I think I was quite discouraged by various things that happened, or rather didn't happen, around that first book. For one thing, it had such a terrible title. It was called Against My Will, Careless Love. Everything about that seemed discouraging. So for all those years, I really was working very hard trying to learn to write short stories.
What did you hate so much about the title, Careless Love?
I thought it was embarrassing and inappropriate. It sounded sort of, little sleazy.
You weren't allowed to use your own title in the book?
Well, I didn't have good sense at the time. My editor said I can't publish a book called The Fall of Daisy Duke, which was my title, by someone named Alice Adams. I mean, to me, the two names are entirely unlike. However, he prevailed. If I'd been, I mean, now I would say, don't be silly. That's my title.
But you have no authority when you're a young writer and you're desperate to get published.
Well, obviously, I had a lot more than I knew I did, usual.
Well, that's interesting, as usual.
But anyway, it was published in England as The Fall of Daisy Duke and did a great deal better there.
Mm-hmm. You were in your 40s when you started to establish yourself as a writer, yes?
Well, let's say in 1966, I was just 40. Is that right? Yes.
So that's when your first book was published. You were 40. Did that affect your self-image as a writer? Because for years, you were someone who probably wanted to be a writer and was writing a lot at home, but wasn't seeing much of it in print.
Well, that's right. It's hard. I mean, you feel like an idiot saying that you're a writer when you're not published.
Since you had such a hard time getting established, and since success came a little later in life than it does for many writers to get published when, you know, those writers lucky enough to get published when they're really young, have you taken an interest in young writers trying to make it?
Yes, I have. I've taught several times. I taught at Davis and at Berkeley and at Stanford, and each time I had, very, very rewarding relationships with younger writers, although I must say that possibly my most rewarding experience as a teacher was with someone who at that time was 74, I think, anyway, a marvelous writer who was in my class at Stanford, Harriet Dorr. I don't know if you read Stone's Free Barra, but it's just an exceptionally good novel, which, you know, and this was Harriet's first novel, which was published when she was, I think, 75.
Huh.
So it's not only young writers I'm interested in encouraging.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because you weren't a young writer in that sense when you started really, you know, blossoming and getting noticed.
That's right.
That's an interesting thing to pay attention to.
Well, I think so. One of the good things about writing is that you can sort of start at any age.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for talking with us about your life and your writing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alice Adams' new novel, Second Chances, is published by Knopf. She lives in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and see what's coming up. Hi, Danny.
Oh, hi, Terry. How are you doing?
What story are you following?
Well, first, the latest complicated developments in the Middle East. The Pentagon announced today it's going to sell all sorts of weapons to Saudi Arabia, including missiles. And this comes, of course, only one day after the Saudis broke diplomatic relations with Iran. And we'll talk with a Middle East specialist about how this could affect the already intricate relations in the Middle East. And on the lighter side, we'll visit one of the world's most interesting basements, the basement of the Museum of Natural History in New York.
What's going on down there?
You're
going
to learn more than you probably ever knew before about dinosaur bones, paleontology, they call it.
Okay, thanks. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In his younger days, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg frequented a watering hole in Italy called the Falcon Club. What attracted him and his English-speaking friends was not only the beer, but the blues.
The Falcon Club was a dingy dive located down a flight of steps near the Piazza Barberini in Rome. I hear they closed it about 10 years ago for gross violations of the fire code. It's no great loss, I suppose. It was only open in the winter months, it had no air conditioning, and by May the heat was suffocating. It was not what you'd call exclusive, either. The only membership requirements were that you put up a $15 fee and that you be a native English speaker. Yet on a typical Thursday night in February, the place was jammed with a wildly improbable assortment of expatriate Anglophone youth. I can recall meeting Irish au pair girls, English journalists, New Zealanders studying art restoration, West Indian medical students, Canadian opera singers, and Americans playing as ringers on Italian pro basketball teams. It was enough to make me stop and wonder what we all had in common, apart from our language. Granted, we could talk to one another, but whatever did we have to talk about? After all, this was not a crowd that cared much about the sorts of things that people like Alistair Cook invoke when they talk about the bonds that unite the English-speaking peoples. We certainly didn't get together to celebrate our magnificent literary heritage, our tradition of jurisprudence, or our shared belief in constitutional democracy. The common denominators of the Falcon Club clientele were a lot lower and a lot more common than that. Yet we did have interests in common, even if they were not the sorts of things you'd build a PBS series around. For one thing, we shared a certain culture of drinking itself. We English speakers like to do our drinking sidled up to the tap, a custom for which Rome provided no adequate settings. Italians are convivial, Lord knows, but they don't go out much just to drink, and when they do, they sit at low sofas in the piano bars and nurse a single $7 glass of brandy for a couple of hours. At the Falcon Club, you could get a beer for a buck. They made up the difference in volume. And then people came for the music. Italian pop music has its charms. It shows what Barry Manilow or Billy Joel might have become if they only had the heart for it. But the Falcon Club had a jukebox that was heavy on the blues and blues-oriented rock that's a specialty of the English-speaking world. In fact, the blues-style singers on the jukebox were from almost as many of the English-speaking nations as the clientele of the club itself. There were black Americans like Ray Charles and white Americans like Elvis and Janis Joplin. There was the Irishman Van Morrison, the South African Manfred Mann, and the Englishman John Mayall and Stevie Winwood. Except for Charles, I suppose that none of them sang what you'd call authentic blues. But all of them had a way of handling a line that showed that they'd spent a lot of time listening to pure blues singers like Muddy Waters or Elmore James with a rapt attention that only somebody who understood the lyrics could have brought to the task. Music may be an international language, but song is often tied to the rhythms of speech. You can't sing Schubert Lieder in Portuguese, and the sweetness of a Brazilian choro will not survive a translation into German. And for the same reason, you can't imagine the blues being sung in Italian or French. In fact, I'm told that there are some Dutch blues bands around, but they sing in English, and the Dutch are sort of honorary English speakers anyway. It gave the patrons of the Falcon Club one more point of reference, something to talk about once we got tired of trying to explain baseball and cricket to one another. They play jazz and rock everywhere from Oslo to Osaka, but only Anglophones sing the blues.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with actor Daniel J. Travanti. He turns out to be surprisingly different from his best-known character, Captain Frank Farrillo, on Hill Street Blues. Travanti co-stars with Faye Dunaway in the new film Midnight Crossing. We'll also have reviews of Eric Clapton's new multi-album retrospective, and White Mischief, the new movie about British upper-class decadence during the twilight of colonial rule in Africa. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.